Hi, I'm Mike Kozer, and welcome to the Lost Ballparks Podcast.
This is Harry Carey with Jack Buck and Jerry Gross from the beautiful new Bush Memorial Stadium. And boy, I tell you, this is some sight.
The crowd still is coming in. The bleacher area in center field almost filled. And the indication is that it's going to be a fine Friday night crowd here at the Polo Grounds.
We're underway in the first of a twi-night doubleheader at Tiger Stadium.
Greetings, baseball fans. This is Mel Allen greeting you from Yankee Stadium in New York City.
The F&M Schaefer Brewing Company, very happy to be pouring it to you from Ebbets Field tonight. And this should be a humdinger.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Al Helfer with Art Gleason bringing you Mutual's Game of the Day from sunny Shy Park in the city of Philadelphia.
Just the start of things. Go pull up a comfortable chair. If you want to take your shoes off, go ahead. Wiggle your toes, and we hope you'll have a cold Schaefer or two throughout the evening.
My friend Andy Strasburg is the author of the best-selling book, My 1961, a remarkable read that serves as both memoir and history of Roger Maris's record-setting 1961 season and what it meant to a 13-year-old fan, Andy, originally hailing from the Bronx. Andy Strasburg's work and writing about the profession of baseball includes 22 years in marketing with the San Diego Padres and 18 years representing high-profile players, as well as consulting for Major League Baseball teams and the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Andy, welcome to the Lost Ballparks podcast. I will start with this as we get to the beginning of your book. The New York Yankees, the team of your youth, made this blockbuster trade with the Kansas City Athletics at the end of the 1959 season that brought Roger Maris to New York. That transaction on December 11th, 1959, would end up changing the course of your life. And I think it's fair to say that almost all of your friends at this point would call themselves Mickey Mantle fans. But you wanted your own player. How did you come to call Roger Maris your guy?
There was a great article in Sport Magazine, which is no longer being published. And the article had the title, Roger Maris Rejuvenates the Yankees. There was a number of labels attributed to Roger Maris that I had never heard before. And I probably did, but it didn't register that he was a team player and that he was a family guy. And being 12 years old, not only was I looking for my own hero, but I guess I didn't know it at the time. I was also looking for a role model, someone that I could look up to. Maris, no one else wanted him. Everybody else wanted Mantle. So I got Rog.
In 1961, what started out, I think, as an autobiography school assignment for you turned into you keeping a detailed account of your life during that historic year of 1961, day by day, month by month. And then who knew that it would turn into one of the most significant years in baseball history?
Yeah, I mean, junior high, Miss Kramer gave us the assignment and we had to write about our lives.
January 30th, your entry talks about Roger Maris signing his contract with the Yankees for $37,000, a pretty substantial raise from, the $18,000 that he made in 1960. And then reading through your book, which is a compilation of all these entries throughout your year, My 1961, it's apparent early on, Andy, that there is a lot of buzz about both Mickey and Roger chasing Babe Ruth's single-season home run record of 60 set back in 1927, which is interesting because if you look at the 1960 statistics, Mickey, I think, had 40, Maris had 39. What made people think at the time that these guys had a legitimate shot to chase Ruth that summer?
It was somewhat of a common theme among sports writers before a season started to pick out a couple of guys and say, these are the guys who are going to challenge Babe Ruth.
Maris did not get off to a quick start in 61. On April 28th, I think he was hitting under 220, 216, something like that, with one home run. But in May and June, Roger picks up steam, and he's hit 28 by the All-Star break. And Roger and Mickey are the only two starters from the 1960 All-Star game selected to start for the American League in the 1961 Midsummer Classic. Back in the day, there were two All-Star games. The first that year was at Candlestick on July 11th, and then Fenway on July 31st. And now that Roger is your own guy, you must have a special feeling for him when he's in the All-Star game and having his name announced as one of the starters.
Well, the American League is two up and two down. On deck is number nine, Roger Maris, the big thumper of the American League.
And he hated Candlestick Park, like a lot of players.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But the date that actually turned me around about Roger Maris, where I thought, boy, how lucky am I to have selected this guy to be my guy, was June 11th. It was a doubleheader, Yankee Stadium. The Yankees were playing the Angels. And in the doubleheader, Roger Maris in the first game catches a would-be home run off the bat of Ken Hunt.
Curveball swung on, hit out to right field.
He actually jumped high above the 44-inch right field fence at Yankee Stadium, caught it, and tumbled backwards into the seats. And the second game, Roger hit two home runs. But the event of the June 11th game that got to me was Maris making that catch. That is the time that turned it around for me, where I thought, this guy is really special.
At some point in the summer, it becomes clear that, I mean, it's not just newspaper fodder anymore, that both Maris and Mantle have a shot at breaking Ruth's record. But the commissioner at the time, Ford Frick, issued a ruling. And reading your book, My 1961, I agree with you that the ruling was ridiculous. Can you talk about what that was?
It was July 17th. July 17th has a number of meanings to me. It was my birthday. July 17th was also the day that Ty Cobb passed away. And Maris hit a home run on July 17th in Baltimore, but it was rained out, so it never made it into the record books. It was interesting, the day that I turned 13, that Ford Frick would announce that Maris, if he was going to break the record, had to do it in 154 games. Well, there's two things that drove me crazy. Eventually, after the season was over, Maris was quoted as saying he did hit 61 home runs in 154 games. He just happened to do it in the last 154 games. But the other part is, and to this day, practically nobody talks about it, it's not the number of games that a player plays, it's the number of plate appearances. The ruling, it was absurd. And as it turns out, in 1961, Maris hit his 60th home run in less plate appearances than Babe Ruth.
Yeah, he sure did. So July 25th, Maris has a day to remember. At a doubleheader against the White Sox at Yankee Stadium, he hits a pair of home runs in each game, giving him 40. And I think it was after this game that you begin to believe now, hey, my guy has a legit shot at Ruth.
I did. It was right around that time that a couple of newspaper guys picked up the fact that the word for home runs between Mantle and Maris was the word Tonks, T-O-N-K-S. And boy, did I love that word. I owned it. It was mine. And yes, I thought Maris had a shot at hitting 61 tonks in 1961. And when a guy gets four home runs in one day in a doubleheader, yeah, you got to think. And you know, he's at the magical 40 mark.
July 29th, as part of your 13th birthday present, your dad treats you to a game at Yankee Stadium. And for a minute, we'll pause our Roger Maris story and hear about how you got to the game, where you and your dad sat, what your impressions of Yankee Stadium were, the sights, smells, and sounds. This obviously wasn't your first trip, but I just want your overall impressions of that ballpark as it stood in 1961.
Yeah, it was a special treat for me because there was a restriction. If I was going to any Yankee games, I had to go with an adult, and my dad was the only one who would take me to games. We got there 15 minutes, traditionally 15 minutes before the game. And as soon as the game was over, we left. But that game was very, very special. My dad figured out the same thing that I figured out. This is pretty cool, these guys going after Ruth's record. And so my dad took me and we got there early enough for us to watch batting practice. And one of my dreams of watching batting practice or at a game was to catch a ball. And so I went out to left field and Nellie Fox hit a batting practice ground rule double and it bounced on the track and I caught it. And I could not believe my good fortune. I had a Major League Baseball. It was the thing that I was hoping about. And I just went and I showed my dad. I was so excited. And it was the first of many baseballs that I would catch, both in batting practice and the game. There's nothing like your first.
No, of course not. Yeah. In your book, My 1961, your entry for August 2nd, you talk about discovering that Bob Serve, Mickey Mantle, and Roger Maris shared a four-bedroom apartment. And they also apparently would carpool to Yankee Stadium, right? The three of them?
Yes. Can you imagine three guys living in your apartment building in Queens? a little bit. I mean, obviously, people knew about it.
Yeah.
They were able to get away with it somewhat undercover and drive from Queens to the Bronx to play ball games.
And I think it was Rogers' 1961 Oldsmobile.
You ride tall in the saddle on higher sit-up seats with thicker foam padding all the way across. And to add to your pleasure underway, there's a new Skyrocket engine and new hydromatic drive with accelerotor action to put new zing in your driving.
Yeah, that had to be very, very special. And I've actually tried to find the exact address and going to the Maris family. And, you know, it was interesting when I asked Pat Maris, Roger's wife, years ago, she looked at me like, I don't remember the address of where they live.
You would think that there would be some, I know they were teammates, but some tension between Mantle and Maris. Both of them obviously want to break the record. Maris is new to the Yankees. And yet here they are living in the same apartment during this crazy year.
Yeah, I don't think that there was tension. I think there was a great deal of pride. And, you know, I'm going to guess that Roger realized that Mickey Mantle was a far superior athlete and baseball player than he was. I don't think that there was any tension between them, but I think the competition, personal competition, especially when it came to home runs. Yeah, I think that was very, very present.
August 20th, 1961, the Yankees were in Cleveland at Cleveland Stadium.
Didn't realize the excitement had been generated since our last road trip through these parts. The Cleveland newspapers had been putting the results of the Indians second headline. The top headline's been what Maris and Mantle have been doing. So it has struck the fancy of the nation as to whether these men will or won't.
Top of the third, Mel Allen has the call for Roger Maris's 49th home run.
Here it is. There goes Gardner. And there is the drive to deep right field. It is going. It is out. Number 49. Coming home behind Gardner, and Mickey Mantle takes his hand at home plate. And it's 5-0, New York. Dial M for murder. Thunder and lightning have struck in Cleveland.
Sitting in your room, listening to your black plastic Zenith radio on your tabletop radio, heard many Mel Allen's calls throughout this season.
He was my tutor when it came to baseball. I learned about baseball. In addition to hearing about the game, I learned about the game from Mel Allen. I was probably amongst a number of people who was not unhappy if there was a rain delay, because Mel Allen would tell stories and he would provide information that during a ball game, there was not enough time. And he would also talk about food and other things going on. Mel had, I think, a very, very unique ability, which I have not seen in other broadcasters, in some of the things that he would say in between pitches. And whether it was a foul ball that hit a hot tin roof or if it had to do with the English language, pretty incredible, but very educational.
I found this fascinating. August 27th, during a game against the A's at Kansas City's Municipal Stadium.
In right field and batting third, Roger Maris, who now has 51 home runs, just 9 behind Babe Ruth's record, with 26 games in which to get them.
Phil Rizzuto had the call on the radio and described A's pitcher Jim Archer at the edge of the dugout filming each Yankee player's at-bat. Who knew that that kind of thing happened way back in 1961?
And you're probably not surprised that I tried to run down that film. I would love to have seen it. He was doing it as a form of, I got to know what this guy's strengths and weaknesses are, because I got to make sure that he doesn't get on base or score.
September 9th, 1961.
September 9th, I was bar mitzvahed. I was very much interested in putting my bar mitzvah that I had studied for all summer long behind me. And after the ceremony, the service, I was in the rabbi's private office, and he looks at me and very seriously says, Andy, today you are a man and you can make your own decisions. Are you going to continue your Hebrew studies? And I looked past the rabbi. There were two gentlemen who were working in his office. And I said, hey, how'd the Yankees do today? And one guy said, Yankees beat Cleveland 8-7. Maris hit his 56th home run. I looked back at the rabbi and I said, no, I'm done.
You're leaving your Hebrew studies for your Yankees education. The following day, go from some laughter to actually something that really shook you up. the event that happened at Yankee Stadium the following day.
I was watching television, the Yankee game on September 10th, and what happened absolutely horrified me. I love to watch defensive outfielders, and one of the greatest back then was Jimmy Pearsall. And Jimmy had a reputation of playing very shallow, and no matter what ballpark that he was, because he was able to go back on a ball. But what he wanted to do was play in so that he could rob base hits. The other reputation that he had was he had some mental illness challenges where he had a breakdown in the 1950s. Well, at one point in the game, two guys jump onto the field and go up to Pearsall and kind of put their fists up as if they're going to fight him. That was a mistake because Pearsall doesn't run from fights.
And somebody takes a swing at Pearsall. Two men take a swing at Pearsall and he goes after him.
He kicked one of the guys and then decked the other one.
Two kids went out and took a swing at Pearsall and the whole Indian ball club. And the police are out there and they got him. Jimmy started to pound them and they got him.
Players came to his aid as well as the security for Yankee Stadium. But Mel Allen did an incredible play-by-play. And the positive, believe it or not, there is a couple of positive things. One of the players who ran to his defense was Mickey Mantle.
And Mickey Mantle is one that's out there. Mickey went out too.
As well as Frank Crosetti, the third base coach. Once things were settled down, Johnny Blanchard steps into the batter's box and crushes the ball going out to the right field bullpen area where the Yankees relievers are sitting, and Jimmy Pearsall robs Johnny Blanchard of a home run.
Swung on. There's a drive to deep right center. And that ball is going to be caught by Pearsall. He took a home run away from Blanchard. How about that? He leaped up and took a home run away.
The other incredible part about that story is that Jimmy's father, I think, had died the week before.
Exactly. I think Jimmy Pearsall was always on edge and was always confronted with people antagonizing him because of the reputation that he had. And so those guys, they went out to pick a fight with the wrong guy on the field.
The inning, after two people had assaulted him, he just committed highway robbery, which is legal on a ball field.
Like most kids, especially from that era, you grew up collecting baseball cards, and you developed a way to determine which packs, without opening them, had the 1960 Topps Roger Maris card.
Yes. Well, first of all, it's a cellophane pack. Baseball cards came in two different ways. One was a wax pack, and you couldn't see what the cards were. The other was a cellophane pack. And so you could see the top card and the bottom card. So I would go in, and I'd look at each of the cellophane packs. And if Maris was on the top or the bottom, then I'd buy it. Then I started thinking to myself, well, wait a minute. If he's on the bottom, perhaps when they distribute the cards, they do it through a machine, and the players that are above Roger Maris will always be in the same sequence. And so I went back to the store. I had memorized the 11 cards in front of Roger Maris, and I went back to the store, and there was one of the cards, and I bought it. I opened it up, and boom!
What is remarkable about that, you're 12 or 13, and you figured this out. You have cracked the Topps code at 12 or 13.
And that doesn't seem unusual to me.
None of your other friends, unless they were privy to it from you, would have been able to figure that out?
No. And I let my buddies know about that when they were no longer interested in buying baseball cards. So I kind of kept that close to my vest, as they say.
And how many Roger Maris 1960 Topps cards did you end up with?
As my wife says, too many.
On September 16th at Detroit's Tiger Stadium, Roger hit home run number 57.
There's a drive to deep right, and there's number 57 off the top of the upper deck. Roger Maris gets number 57.
Al Kaline picks it up, throws it into the Yankee bench, which I kind of think tells you everything you need to know about Al Kaline. Just a good guy, doesn't have to throw that into the Yankee bench, but he picks up the ball and realizes how important it is to Roger Maris.
There were a number of writers who tried to make a big deal out of that because they didn't think that Roger appreciated it. And quite frankly, of course he appreciated it. You know, he was not concentrating on getting a home run that bounces back onto the field. There were some writers who were not happy with Roger Maris, and they were out after him. And Roger answered questions, but not as colorful as a number of writers wanted. And so they were going to put Roger in his place because they had the ink to do it.
September 17th, the following day, Roger hits number 58. September 20th, the Yankees are in Baltimore at Memorial Stadium, and Roger hits 59.
I imagine after all this is over, somebody may write a story or two about the month-long, day-in, day-out, excruciating pressure. There's one. It is going. It is going. It is going.
And that marks a pretty historic moment because I think he had hit, at that point, a home run in every American League ballpark that season.
Yes. And there's a couple of things about that. And I'm so glad that you brought that up. Yes, 59 in Baltimore, game 154. And keep in mind, on July 17th, Roger hit a home run in Baltimore, but it was washed out. So Roger gets home run number 59. Now, I'm answering all the critics who said, yeah, Maris, he batted in front of Mickey Mantle. He never got an intentional walk. Well, he never got an intentional walk is correct. However, when people say that Roger Maris had it easy because he was batting in front of Mickey Mantle, the three home runs that were the hardest to hit, in my opinion, were home runs number 59, which we're talking about, number 60 and 61. Mantle was not in the lineup
for
any of those home runs.
Right. September 26th, Roger hits number 60 into the right field upper deck at Yankee Stadium.
There it is. There it is. If it stays fair, there it is, number 60.
Now, for that game, are you listening on the radio or are you watching it in your family's den on the Magnavox?
I am now glued to the TV. And I'm watching the ball hit the cement step and come back on to the field. And I'm pretty excited, pretty happy. And I mean, this is going great for me.
This is most unusual. They are asking him to come out of the dugout. Now, this is something.
And clubhouse manager Pete Sheehy, who was there for Babe Ruth's 60th in 1927, he was there also for Roger's 60th that late September day, right?
And according to Pete, they both hit approximately in the same area.
Okay, which brings us, Andy, to October 1st, 1961. You're back in your family's den watching the Yankees play the Red Sox. It's the bottom of the fourth inning. Roger Maris comes to the plate.
Here comes Roger Maris. Just standing up, waiting to see if Maris is going to hit number 61. Here's the windup. Fastball hit deep to right.
He did it. Two balls, no strikes. And Tracy Stallard, God bless him, challenged Roger with a fastball. And Roger connected and hit his 61st tonk.
61 home runs. And they're still fighting for that ball out there. People are climbing over each other's back.
The guy who catches the ball, Sal Durante?
Sal Durante. 19 years old from Brooklyn, and he went with his girlfriend, who later on would marry Rosemary. And
not only does he catch the ball, but he's brought up to the broadcast booth.
Right. And here's where it gets a little bit crazy for me. I'm putting together this book, My 1961, and I vividly recall that Sal Durante was brought up to the broadcast booth, and now Mel Allen's going to interview him. And I thought, I wonder if anybody has that recording. I wonder. And I went on the internet and I found the guy, the only guy to have that recording, Phil Geis. And I reach out to him and I say, can I buy that recording from you? And he said, yeah, for $5,000.
Oh my God.
I said, I don't have $5,000. And I said, how about, would you be able to transcribe it? Just put it in writing, word for word, everything that was said, so I can have it and put it in my book. And he said, you know what, give me a couple of days. He then calls me back and he said, I'm going to make you a deal. Tell you what, I'm going to send you a letter with 10 questions about Roger Maris and your relationship. you answer those questions, sign the letter and send it back to me. And he says, I'll send you the recording, no charge. And so I've got the recording, and part of the deal was I could never play it for anybody. And I have it, I transcribed it, and word for word, that interview between Sal Durante and Mel Allen is part of the book.
It was a historic year for Roger Maris and the Yankees. New York would go on to beat the Reds in the 1961 World Series 4-1.
The game is over. The Yankees are champions of the world for the season of 1961. In the last inning, the Reds went down 1-2-3.
But that is not where this story ends. Really? It's only the beginning. Because, Andy, now that you had your very own favorite Yankee, you still had a dream of one day meeting him, owning one of his bats, and an authentic Roger Maris home run ball. And what happened in 1962 and beyond is every bit as captivating as the home run chase itself in 1961, with quite a few more twists and turns. It started at the end of 1961, when your parents decide to lift their restriction that you had to be with a chaperone to go to Yankee Stadium. You now had a plan in place for how you would get to the ballpark and how you would meet Roger Maris. What was your plan for getting to Yankee games?
Taking the bus and the elevated train. You know, it was relatively easy, incredibly safe, and I would always go with a friend. But I will tell you, I started to run out of friends because I went pretty often, and the response from friends were, what? We just went to a game. We're going to another game? And so I had to move on, find more friends.
Back in the early 60s, players would park across the street from Yankee Stadium. So your plan to meet Roger actually started in the parking lot.
It did. It was 157th Street. They parked on the other side, and then they would walk across 157th Street to Yankee Stadium. And that's when a lot of kids would run up and try to get autographs. But you had to get there pretty early. 2 o'clock game, I would get there 8, 9 o'clock in the morning. You know, the purpose was to catch the players before they actually walked across the street. I always felt that it was my responsibility to escort them. How else were they going to find Yankee Stadium if it wasn't for me?
You knew that you were going to have to do something to stand out from the crowd. It's not just you. There's a throng of kids greeting these players each day in the parking lot. So you came up with making notes for Roger.
I did, but I can't really justify that it was a plan. It was the result of I was too nervous to talk to him. And I wanted to communicate with him and figured the best way to do that would be to write a note and hand it to him. Now, I should explain that it was a very, very common practice back in those days. If you wanted an autograph from a player, and if they were hustling from the parking lot into Yankee Stadium, if you were smart enough, you gave them a self-addressed stamped postcard. And they would take it, and then they'd walk into the ballpark, and then they'd just sign their name and drop it in the mail, and it would come back to you. Well, that's where I got the idea of, I'm going to do something similar to that. So I would write a note about the previous games, regardless of what Roger did, and I would always be positive, and I would sign it, your most loyal fan, Andy Strasburg. Eventually, Roger looked for me to hand this to him because I was too nervous. I couldn't talk. I couldn't verbally say anything to him because he was Roger Maris. And he actually got to the point where he extended his left hand over the kids looking for my note. So it became a tradition. That was the perfect way for me to communicate with him.
Tell me about the baseball that was given to you by Roger during batting practice, a ball that you still have.
I do. Once we got into the ballpark, one of my friends said, why don't you ask Maris for a batting practice baseball? And I was kind of nervous. And the other thing is, I didn't want to get turned down. Well, finally, I got up enough nerve and I said, Raj, can I have a ball? To my shock and astonishment, he turns around after catching in batting practice a fly ball and underhands it to me. And I was so startled, I couldn't lift up my left hand or my right hand. They just stayed at my side. The ball hit my left shoulder, rolled away, and another kid got it. And Roger's going in to take batting practice. And, you know, all of a sudden, the real me came out and I was no longer shy. And I screamed, "Roger, I didn't get the ball. I didn't get the ball." And he heard me. And he stopped and he spoke to Phil Lynch, utility infielder for the Yankees. And then Phil came walking out to right field, keeping in mind that the right field fence at Yankee Stadium was only 40 inches high. And he comes up to me and looks me in the eye and he says, "Hold out your hand." And I hold out my hand and he places a baseball in my hand. And I turned to my buddy and I said, "Look, I got a baseball from Roger Maris." And my buddy said, "No, you didn't. You just got a baseball from Phil Lynch." Yeah, I still have that baseball, and it is identified as a baseball from Roger Maris.
Of course. Yeah, that's so great. In 1965, this would be the year that I think you graduated from high school. At this point, you just come out and ask Roger for one of his bats and also a home run ball. I love your courage, by the way, to just, you don't know unless you ask. So you come out and ask for both.
That was my mom. She said, "You'll never know unless you ask. And what's the worst they can say is no."
Right.
So I got up enough courage and asked him for one of his bats and one of his home run baseballs. And he said, "Well, as far as the baseball goes, the home run baseball, you'll have to catch it. But the next time I crack one of my bats, I'll give it to you." Well, the Yankees go on the road. They're actually playing in California against the Angels. And I'm listening to the game.
Weather in Los Angeles is delightful. Breeze blowing out towards left field.
And because of the time difference, it's 8:30 in California, 11:30 at night in New York. And my lights are out in my bedroom. My parents think I'm asleep. I'm underneath the covers and I'm listening to my transistor radio. And I hear the Yankee broadcaster explain that Roger cracked his bat and he's going to the dugout for a new piece of lumber. Well, the next day, my best friend, Gary Baker, called, who also listened to the game. And he said, "Andy, did you hear the game?" And I said, "Yeah, Yankees won 8-7. He said, "No, Maris cracked his bat. That's the bat he promised you." Well, I didn't say anything. The Yankees come in off the road and I get to Yankee Stadium and Roger's car is already in the parking lot. So I couldn't catch him before he got in to the ballpark. The gates open up. I run out to right field. Here comes Roger to shag some fly balls during batting practice. But instead of stopping, turning around and catching fly balls, he comes up to me and he says, "I've got that bat for you just before the game starts. Come to the dugout and I'll give it to you." I could not believe this is the greatest day of my youth. It's the confirmation of a promise from my childhood hero.
Yeah.
I run over to the dugout and as luck would have it, a security guard, and he must have been at least 7 feet tall, maybe 300, 400 pounds. And I, with all sincerity, I say, "Hi, my name is Andy Strasburg, good friend of Roger Maris's. He promised something. He said he'd meet me here. You got to believe me." I mean, I'm not sitting in those seats. So I realize I'm in dangerous territory of getting kicked out. And the cop, the security guard says, "Hey, kid, settle down. If Maris said he'd be here, he'll be here. Just give him a few minutes." And about 20 minutes later, here comes Raj walking into the dugout from the clubhouse with my bat. I got to tell you, this is the first time in my life I wanted to go home before the game started because I was concerned about having this Roger Maris bat, which meant everything to me. My buddy convinced me that we should stay for the game, and we did and ran home and told everybody in the neighborhood, I've got a game-used Roger Maris bat. And keep in mind, players didn't do that back then.
So this is how many years? This is 35, let me do quick math, 58 years ago. And today that bat is where?
I'm looking at it. And that bat is a member of the family. That day, I actually gave the bat a name of Woodrow. But obviously, we're pals, and he goes by the nickname Woody.
It's one of the best stories, and they just get better because in 1967, you are a freshman at Akron University. The previous winter, Roger Maris had been traded from the Yankees to the Cardinals, And on May 9th of 1967, you convince your college buddies to make the trek to Forbes Field in Pittsburgh to watch the Cardinals play the Pirates. And you have to assure their highly skeptical minds that you will, in fact, introduce them to your friend that day, Roger Maris.
That's exactly right. But I will tell you that with a 2.5-hour ride from Akron, Ohio to Pittsburgh, I was as nervous as can be because Roger had never seen me other than at Yankee Stadium. So there was a risk involved. And we get to Forbes Field. It's about 20 minutes before the game. And I see Raj warming up in front of the visitor's dugout. We're in a Cardinal uniform, and now his number is still 9, but it's a red number 9 because he's with the St. Louis Cardinals. And with my buddies behind me, I go up to the dugout, the edge, and I kind of hesitantly say, Raj? He turns around, he looks at me, and he says, Andy Strasburg, what the hell are you doing here in Pittsburgh? And I said, well, Raj, a lot of the guys from college wanted to meet you. They lined up as if it was a wedding reception. I introduced each one of them. I was on cloud 9.
And on that young day in May, the stars align in an absolutely no way you can script this beautiful, miraculous way.
Yeah, the game's about to begin. I wished Roger good luck. And now I'm going to go sit and watch the game. And being a superstitious baseball fan, like many baseball fans, for me, the superstition is the number 9. And the reason is because Roger's number is 9. He plays right field. And if you score, that's 9. And I go out and I sit in right field at Forbes Field. I sit in row 9, seat 9, and it's May 9th, 1967. In the sixth inning, Roger Maris gets up for the second time in the ballgame, and he's facing tough left-hander Woody Fryman. Fryman tries to get a curveball by him. Roger connects and hits his first National League home run. I caught the ball.
Roger Maris, here's the pitch. There she goes!
It's unbelievable. Honestly, there's no way to script this. Now you've met Roger Maris. You have a game-used cracked bat from Roger Maris. And you have caught a home run ball.
His first National League home run ball. And after the inning was over, he came running out again. This is during the game. He didn't stop in right field. He came up to the fence. Here I am. I've got tears of joy just running down my face. And my buddies are slapping me on the back. They're hooting and hollering. And I'm frozen. And he comes up and he looks at me. He says, I don't believe it. And as best as I could, I said, I don't believe it either, Roger.
But the story doesn't end there, because on August 3rd, 1990, you in a very specific way become part of the Maris family.
Roger and Pat had 6 children, 4 boys and 2 girls. And one of the sons is Randy. And Randy Maris and I became good friends, good enough friends where we would take vacations together. Randy and his wife, Fran, would come to San Diego. My wife and I would go to Gainesville, Florida, stay with them. We were on a cruise once. We did a car trip together. And on August 3rd, 1990, Randy Maris and his wife, Fran, called me from a hospital to tell me that Fran had just given birth to a baby boy, and they were going to name the baby boy Andrew, and wanted to know if I would be the godfather. And never, ever in my wildest imagination did I ever think about the possibility of my childhood hero's grandson being my namesake and being my godson.
And then you fast forward a little bit. Andrew Maris turns 13. And you took him, I think his dad, right? Is that right?
Yeah, I took Andrew and his mom and dad. I wanted to escort Andrew to his first game at Yankee Stadium. And they agreed. We met at Yankee Stadium. And my surprise guest was Sal Durante, who had caught Roger's 61st home run. Everything came together It was wonderful. It was beautiful. It was another make-believe idea, dream come true. Here I am with Andrew Maris, and he's 13 years old, and we're watching the Yankees and sitting out in right field. But we didn't catch any baseballs that day.
If there was ever a movie that needed to be made about a true story, it is this book, My 1961. It is a great read, and I'm so thankful that you have taken time to share it with us from start to finish. And there's so many tidbits, by the way, that we didn't have a chance to even get to, surprises that you will find throughout the book that will captivate you like they did me.
Well, thank you. I, you know, a lot of people said, who did you write the book for? Honestly, I wrote it for me.
Right.
I kept notes and I just had the most incredible summer of my life in 1961. And so it was very easy to write. And if you love baseball, baseball trivia and baseball minutiae, My 1961, it's in there.
Anytime summer comes around, you need to have at least two or three great summer reads. I would make one of them My 1961. And the second, Andy's new book. Can you talk about that? And by the way, we'll have links to both books inside the podcast notes for those who want to quickly access them. But talk about the new book.
Now, the new book just came out. It's called Home Runs, Tales of Tonks, Taters, Contests, and Derbies. And it starts with Babe Ruth and the home runs that he hit. And I found some information about home runs, about bounce home runs. Up until 1930, a ball that bounced into the stands was considered a home run. And no, Babe Ruth never hit a bounce home run, but Lou Gehrig did. As a matter of fact, he hit two. And one of them was the first grand slam. And for those baseball fans who know who held the record for grand slams in a career, it was Lou Gehrig. But the first one was a bounce home run. And the real nugget in this particular book is that Roger Maris, Jim Gentile, and Harmon Killebrew, after the 1961 World Series, they went to North Carolina and put on five exhibition home run derbies. And I collected all the information, which had never been published before, for each one. I found photographs that were taken that were never published. They were mislabeled in a library from North Carolina, and I crammed as many of those photographs in Home Runs, Tales of Tonks, Taters, Contests, and Derbies as the publisher allowed me to.
Oh, that's fantastic. Okay, so again, we've got those in the podcast notes for those who want to check them out. Also on the website at lostballparks.com. Andy Strasburg, thank you so much for the time and sharing these stories with us. I really appreciate it.
I love telling this story. Thanks for listening.
One quick footnote on this incredible story. Do you remember the movie 61, directed by Billy Crystal? Well, Billy, not surprisingly, asked Andy to be a consultant for the movie. And if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. There's a scene where Maris hits home run number 61 and is running back to the dugout when a fan runs on the field to congratulate him. Billy Crystal asked Andy to play that part in the movie, a fitting tribute to a friendship that lasted years and continues to this day with Roger's kids and grandkids. The Lost Ballparks podcast is produced by Briggs Buckingham, Mike Lipinski, Mike Dunn, Mandy Zavlakis, John Carter, Brian Bingert, Alex Kemp, Xavier Guerra, Ryan Beard, and Kyle Schmidt. Thanks so much for listening. See you next week for another episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.